I said it before and I'll say it again. Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
For today's episode, we have Patty Gleason as a guest. Patty's a professional paintball player for the Seattle Thunder, and he's also one of our coaches here at Vigor Ground Fitness and Performance. And even though Patty's a phenomenal coach, we actually shift gears a little bit and talk about his story and his life. You see, Patty has a pretty impressive and powerful story of overcoming addictions, overcoming struggles, and overcoming this false sense of who he thought he should be on this journey we call life. So I'm extremely appreciative of him being open and candid with us and sharing that story, because I know that there's somebody that's out there that's going to listen to this and really walk away with some powerful messages of how to get through it, and really kind of a message of hope. So again, I want to thank Patty for this, and without further ado, let's get to it. Patty Gleason.
Hey, in the building.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Patty.
It's like from the beginning.
From the beginning.
All right, man. Sure. Born and raised out of Maui, Hawaii. Got two other sisters, so three of us. All of us are from the islands. And just grew up there and kind of had a regular childhood, you know. Nothing that was too crazy or anything like that. Just played a lot of sports. School was on and off, but getting into trouble earlier. But being up, born and raised on an island, it has its benefits and kind of has its drawbacks as well. And I think growing up, you kind of always have two groups of people, you know, the kind that would always stay on the island, you know, never really had any intentions to leave. And then the other group, which my sister definitely falls into, of just wanting to experience the world and get out and live somewhere else before either have the option of going back and growing roots, or if you, you know, just stay on the mainland, you stay on the mainland. So my sister, she moved off when she was 18 up to Seattle. She's always lived in the Renton area. And then I moved off after high school and then went back for a little bit. But that's kind of jumping back and forth. But growing up, definitely was into the whole, you know, soccer was my main sport. Played tennis. My dad's a professional golfer, so I kind of lived on the golf course as well. But then also got into like skateboarding, bodyboarding, and then ultimately paintball was the big one.
And living on an island, you know, everybody has this, obviously this perception that it's, especially Hawaii, right, where it's, you're in paradise every
yeah.
day. And everybody lives a more relaxed life. Everybody lives in, at a slower pace. Is that, do you find that to be true?
On the contrary, yeah, no. I mean, it is definitely slow pace, and it's a different lifestyle. And, I, you know, ultimately when I tell people I'm from Maui, they, you know, obviously hit me back with, what are you doing up here? Right. And it's like, you know, and that's kind of what I was going into. It's like, you kind of have this mindset early on of making this decision at an early age. It's like, well, obviously my parents encouraged me to go to college and kind of get out into the world and stuff like that. So you are at an early age kind of introduced with this question about whether or not you're going to stay on the island or not.
Right.
And, growing up there and just living on an island period, no, you just like everything else. I mean, there, you know, we could really go into it though, but you know, got the whole cultural kind of, repression and the hostility that's directed towards, tourism industry, which is the leading, you know, industry
right.
in the state. And so you get all of these, like, you just get, escaping the word, but it's just like you get introduced to all of these things pretty early. And then, you know, culturally being mixed too, because I, you know, Hawaiian Chinese, but I also got the Haole side, which is, you know, Caucasian. Mm-hmm. So it's like growing up, and that's been a big struggle in my journey of kind of identifying. Wow. You know what I mean? So I mean, because I look white, Irish predominantly, but right. you know, I also, I'm a, you know, just as much Chinese as I am Irish, and you just right. can't tell with Hawaiian too. And like, you know, being Hawaiian in Hawaii, you do have a sense of pride for your culture, right? But when you don't look that part, you do get the and the opposite end of the spectrum where people are targeting you.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? And so at an early age as a young boy, I'm always felt like, and I don't think I've ever shared this on the podcast, but it's like I almost felt ashamed, you know, of both sides. Definitely felt ashamed of the Caucasian side because of the things that you're taught and the whole overthrow and this and that. And then also feel ashamed for my Hawaiian side because I get, you know, looked at through my Hawaiian peers a certain way.
A little different.
Right? And looked differently and like almost discredited my Hawaiian side because I don't look that part. So that was just one of the things that, you know, you experience growing up, and it gets pretty boring. I think, you know, just doing the same thing over and over and over again. And some people are content with that, whether it's fishing or surfing or, you know, anything like that. People find their niche early and then just know that that's what they're going to do.
And are okay with it.
And are, right? Oh, and all power to them, mm-hmm. you know, like there's nothing wrong with that. I never found my identity in surfing or fishing or farming or anything like that.
Right.
So I was always a wandering soul in that part. And so it's like, it just gets boring. Like I moved off, like I said earlier, after high school. And then that's kind of where another chapter of my life takes me. But then when I came back and kind of got my life together, I needed to give it another shot because I was not ready to
right. Almost grow almost roots like you had yet. A different mindset for it.
And oh, completely.
To a certain extent too,
yeah,
right?
Of completely.
Just, of things that you didn't, that you probably took for granted. And it's understandable and it's okay. And I talk with a lot of people about that, that, you know, there is no right or wrong because that's all you knew.
Yeah.
Right? So growing up, you're brought up in this environment. You don't know really what's out there. Right. And I push all my younger cousins nowadays, you know, that grow up in Texas and to say, and like go out and just experience. Right. Because if all you know is Texas or El Paso, to be exact, then I'm not saying like it's bad to be in El Paso. Right. What I'm saying is there's more.
Yeah.
And if you go out and experience it and you say, you know what, that's not for me. Like home is home and I want to go back. Man, there's, you know, more power to you.
Right.
But at least have the objective or have, you know, to step out and find or look at things in a different perspective.
And it's funny that you bring that up because I remember as a kid too, always resenting because I had friends that would live up, you know, I had one of my best friends lived in Oregon as well. And it wasn't a bad resentment. I just always resented that they could just go drive somewhere.
Right.
You know, and the cost of going and traveling somewhere was not that much.
Right.
Whereas when you come from some of the lower ends from the island, it's like plane tickets are freaking right. expensive. You right. know what I mean? So it's like the idea of going on a plane and flying somewhere, it's like not only is it just like that's a long distance, but it's like it's that's expensive, and
right.
you know, not all the families can afford that kind of stuff. Like growing up, I knew people that hadn't leave the island
wow.
till they were like late teens, and maybe wow. even more than that. You know what I mean? Like so, there are people that just haven't even left the island to go to the outer island. So it's like really growing up in such a tight-knit community, and it's like you really know, you know, you get to know everybody. It's a little bit different now. I mean, it's obviously changed from when my parents first got there. It's even changed from my tutu or my grandma when she grew up there, mm-hmm. and then like even during my generation of growing up, and then now it's like the islands are always expanding. Like I said, tourism is a huge industry. They're taking over a lot of the land and stuff like mm-hmm. that, and always developing. So it's like from even when I grew up where it was an even smaller community than it was, you know, now. So it's like,
right.
you just know everything.
Right. So tell us a little bit about, I mean, I know you have an interesting story, and that's, you know, one of the things that I wanted you to share. And I appreciate your openness and candidness to share that. But tell us a little bit about, you know, when you moved to Oregon, because I know that's kind of where, like you said, that next chapter of your life kind of took you mm-hmm. and how that came about.
Yeah, thanks. And I know it actually does start even way before that. You know, I think just from the demographics of being on the island and experiencing all the different levels of classes, I guess you could say. There has always been, like you've talked about, like people thinking that it's like paradise living on an island. It's like, well, our substance abuse problem is pretty bad that they don't like to mention, you know. Methamphetamine was a big one, almost like the crack epidemic. Meth, there was a meth epidemic during the 90s. Wow. In the islands, and so that kind of carried on to the parents and generations right before me and behind me, and continue. And so, I mean, with that being said, like growing up, like I said, I really felt insecure as a kid. I think a lot of insecurities stemmed from just my identity crisis with cultural, awareness. And I just never felt right as a kid. And ultimately, you know, by the sixth grade, I was, you know, smoking weed and drinking, and that shortly progressed to popping pills and stuff like that by the eighth grade. So it's like substances have been in my life from a very early age, and it really just started off as something to do. Mm-hmm. And I fall back on that. Like, you get bored on an island, and you can find a real easy escape, right, in changing your mindset. You know what I mean? So it's like that really started kind of where everything has got to now. And so started using early, was skateboarding. That kind of goes hand in hand with that extreme sports. Paintball is kind of in that same world. I was also into music, so I was playing in a band. By the eighth grade, I was in an all high school band, like rock band. And so they were playing at parties and stuff, right, like that. And like, bless my mom. I mean, I probably wasn't the most subdued child. So I was like always wanting to go to these parties, always nagging at her. And she would let me go play these parties. And, you know, we would party. And this was like, you know, eighth grade. But prior to that, sixth, seventh, and leading up to eighth, I got pretty good at partying. And that's always what I viewed it as, right? It was just partying,
right,
substance use, partying, so just being social. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that lasted all through high school. My drug use continued to progress until I was a senior in high school, and I was getting ready to go to college. And, you know, we went to, this is a little side note, we went to Italy as one of the school trips. When I was a senior, we already had graduated. I was already 18, but they let us go with the school. So there was freshmen and sophomores all the way leading up, but we were over there, we're legal to, right, do whatever we wanted. So we were just running amok in Italy. And that was just some crazy stories. Got in fights with my teachers and just was wilding out. So that was leading up to kind of going into Vegas. I actually went to UNLV right out of high school.
Okay.
And that, you know, just continued getting into trouble. Never made it to class. Got asked politely by the dean to not come back. So I don't know how many people can say they got kicked out of Las Vegas UNLV. So I was, and then, so that at that point, substance abuse was not on my radar. I just was like, man, everyone else's fault, right? Right. Like, nothing, right, is my fault. Like, that school is just not my thing. And my oldest sister, who's 9 years older than me, graduated from U of O. Mm. And like, I've always had ties to the Northwest and stuff like that. So to kind of just speed throughing this, ended up in Eugene, Oregon. And went there with a few of my other friends. We rented this house. And just in Eugene, the party scene, it's a college town, so it's like party scene. I was, this is when I kind of was, you know, growing up, always selling weed and stuff like that. But that's where I really got introduced to some of the other stuff to sell. So drug dealing in a college campus, like, really found my niche.
You found it.
I got there and I was like, man, I'm good at this. And so, you know, that kind of took over my role and my identity. And, you know, I was at this time trying to go professional paintball. And ultimately, you know, the game took over, and there was this decision at one point where I was knocking at the door to go professional playing paintball or go for this other life.
Right.
And by then I was using heavily. And then so I was just much more like, drawn to doing that. Like, I was making money and I was supporting my habit. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it was like, at that time, it was like no brainer. Went that course. And this was right about the time when I started using heroin IV. And that's really when it went downhill. You know, it started from popping oxys, and then it was smoking oxys, and then I have, you know, quickly progressed to just straight up shooting heroin.
Wow.
All within months. And then I really spent, you know, a couple of years doing that, and just shortly but surely, like, getting just physically and spiritually and mentally just bankrupt. You know what I mean? I completely lost my identity, was so consumed with this lifestyle that I invested so much in. And I think, like, a lot of things with, like, media and just like that, you get so force-fed that this is, like, what life should look like. Yeah. I felt like I'm kind of living this rock star lifestyle. I just feel like shit, though, all the time. This is just not working.
Is it really what they say, you know, as far as, like, you're just chasing the next high, or is it more of that you get into almost, quote unquote, the lifestyle that is just the norm? Like, yeah. You just do it at certain times of day because it's just the norm.
I think there's not one. I mean, from all the things that people say, like, it's just not that black and white. You know what I mean? Yes, I was chasing the high, but I was also using just to stay well.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? I wasn't, like, I was shooting heroin. I wasn't even getting high. I was just doing it so that I wouldn't feel sick.
So that was your baseline now.
Yeah, that was the baseline. And then you just continue doing that during the day, because if you don't, then you're going to feel like shit. So it's like basically just a maintenance program.
Wow.
You know, a very dangerous maintenance program. And then, you know, I really felt the addiction to the game and to that lifestyle. Like, I always just really, like, don't get me wrong, I love hip hop music and I love all of that stuff. I was just so engulfed in that and invested my identity into that I just felt like that was the lifestyle, you know what
right.
I mean?
Right. Well, I've heard stories, you know, talking to other people and especially, you know, addressing, you know, as a dealer, right? That you do become kind of like that rock star status, right? Because you're the go-to guy, right? And I remember talking to some friends and being that go-to guy, you know, that has the money, that everybody's happy to see, right? That you get addicted to that feeling. And again, you know, the what the media portrays and all that, as far as with the movies, right? Like, drug dealers are always meant to look like these just, like, tough dudes.
Larger than life.
Yeah, that just have everything, and they kind of run their world, and to a certain extent they do, but, you know, they don't show the other side of it, of, like, the day-to-day struggles with yourself and just identity. And again, you know, if you're saying that the baseline was now that high, then, man, that's, you're obviously tiptoeing with a very, very dangerous, you know, dangerous thing.
Yeah, and, like, kind of in hindsight, you know, when you know, it does come up that I get clean, but during that process of it, you know, not to jump too far forward, but it's like I realized how much I was just addicted to the game, to my phone ringing, to being on everybody's call list during that day, to, like, almost that false sense of being wanted, right? Obviously, when you don't have the dope, no one's going to call you. But it's like when you're that guy, like, your phone's always ringing, always cash in your pocket. Like, yeah, it's very easy to get addicted to that lifestyle. Not necessarily the drugs, even though physically and mentally you end up getting addicted to that, but more so that image. And definitely I dove into just the masculinity, like, gender roles and like how you bring that kind of that power trip, you know, that alpha.
That can engulf you itself.
Yes. Right. And so all of that has really come out during the self-work of getting clean.
And I think that, you know, that goes not only for that world, but I think in general, especially now, right, we always have this conversation of what social media does, right? And how it can pull people to want to look like they have that lifestyle more than they actually do, right? And I think, you know, in discussion with multiple people that you know, I was on this panel talking about, like, social media, how it pulls people in the negative way, and how can we turn it around? And we came to the conclusion that I don't think we're ever going to be able to turn that around, right? Because social media, that's what it's there for. Social media is, at the end of the day, it's there to sell. Sell an image, sell a product, sell yourself, obviously, right? Like whatever it is that you're trying to show or trying to share with people. The majority of people, that's what they get from social media. So I can imagine a similar pool, right? To where, again, you're the guy, you're the man. Again, your phone's ringing, but if you don't have it, your phone's not going to ring. So at what point, I always ask the question, at what point is it okay, right? Especially when we're having the conversation on social media, is where too much is too much, right? With the fakeness and, you know, posting pictures of stuff. Maybe you do have it, maybe you don't. And if you do have it, then you can't even afford to pay it, right? Because I know a lot of people like that, that I'll look at their Facebook, I mean, their Instagram feed, and it's just like, I'm like, I know what's really going on, and it doesn't look like that, you know what I mean? But it's just crazy because they're so engulfed in that, that it's almost like they believe it.
Yeah.
They believe that they have the life that they really don't have.
Right? And it's like, and then you got to take the step, it's like, why even go through the efforts of portraying that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. And it's just, that's the kind of, you know, and oh, it's just the business. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think that's an excuse that we tell ourselves all the time, that self-narrative of just like doing things against kind of your gut feeling of justifying, well, that's just the business, right? Or that's what guys do, or vice versa, that's what women do, you right. know? And it's like, really, I've found, and especially, you know, with my work as a substance abuse counselor for adolescents, it's just, through social conditioning, we have lost that disconnect to gut feelings. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because we are just forced to do so much stuff that we don't want to do. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that has become the norm.
Right.
Where it's like the stuff that we see is not normal.
Well, and I think there's the, you know, without skipping too much forward, but there is a discussion where people always, you know, we discuss this comfort zone, right? And I think it gets misinterpreted because, you know, the gut feeling, not going with the gut feeling, a lot of people take it as like, oh, well, I'm getting out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do this because I'm getting out of my comfort zone. But it's like, no, like there's a fine line where that's just, you should go with your gut feeling, right? And don't go and don't take it or try to flip the script on it to where now you're justifying your actions because, well, I did it because I'm stepping out of my comfort zone, right? Where everybody nowadays preaches that. And I believe in that too, that there are some points in time where you have to get out of your comfort zone to keep growing or to reach the next level of whatever it is that you're working at. But don't get it twisted to where you're using it as an excuse to justify essentially all the bad decisions you're making.
Yeah.
Right. So tell me a little bit about, I guess taking a step back, at what moment did you decide like I've had enough?
Yeah.
And I've got to get clean.
Yeah, so I kind of ran through my story pretty fast and jumped over a bunch of stuff. So I think going back to kind of this gut feeling, I'm glad we brought that up because I can kind of start this next part with Perfect. It. And growing up, always been very pretty spiritually connected. You know, I think that runs in our family for sure. My mom has always been like that. And like the connectiveness that we've all shared within a family unit has always been really strong. Mm-hmm. And prior to sitting down with you, I was kind of trying to jog a little self-narrative about it. And it's like, I don't know if I was just afraid of that connection or what. I've talked about previously on when I've shared my story, something that always resonated with me with addiction is just being a disease of feelings and not being able to cope with them. And because that has really been something that I've tried to tackle my entire life, you know, and being at a young age, I was a very emotional young kid. And then with this spirit, you know, the spirituality and connectiveness within my family deep down. And then you sprinkle on this conflict that I had culturally with identity, sprinkle all of that on. And it was just a lot for me to feel. So like when I initially started to use, it was a way for me to escape all of those feelings. And like doing that at such a young age and making that connection between the two, I think that that's why it stuck with me for so long, because I realized like, I can ignore all of this powerful stuff in my life and just forget about it for a little bit.
Right.
And so talking about losing that gut feeling, along that course of my addiction, my using years, I really lost the disconnect to, you know, the whole spirituality, connect with my higher power. Like I, you know, something that I, by the end of the journey missed,
okay.
You know, like I could remember being like that when I was younger, and somewhere along the lines, it was gone. It was lost. Yes. And so like, yeah, like I said, by the time I was in Eugene, like I threw my paintball the dream away. I was not in the best relationship. I was jumping from house to house. Like we lived in, and I say we, me and my ex-girlfriend, we lived in our friend's tool shed for a little bit. And but the freaking insanity, right, is that I had money. I had money. Right. I just didn't want to spend it on a place to live. Like, I don't know. It's just the insanity of addiction. And so we literally lived in our friend's tool shed for a little bit. And then I upgraded and went and lived in a friend's basement for a little bit. And that's kind of ultimately the last stop that we were at. And we were in there. And by this time, I just really... maybe, you know, it was probably a calling at the time. I just didn't see it, but I just needed to get out of the game. I was just like, this is just not working for me. And was looking around our basement room, I guess you say, the drug den, and you know, there's just needles everywhere, dirty trash just everywhere. It was just not a good place to be living, and I just was sick of it. And so I like I said, I had a pretty good business built, quote unquote. And I tell this story and everybody laughs like, what the hell? So I sold my business. I had all my contacts, and like, it's like clockwork, right? I mean, I have all my contacts. I knew all these people would hit me up every single day, and you know, I'd make so much money on every given day. And I sold that to someone, and just like that.
So they essentially just took over.
They took over and paid me money for it.
Wow.
So a young young entrepreneur at its finest. And so me and my ex-girlfriend, we got rid of all our stuff, shipped up, brought a little bit of dope with us back to Maui and moved back. And, you know, I shared this on the last podcast, like, God bless my mom's soul, my parents' soul. We moved back the day before Thanksgiving. We brought just enough dope to get us through that day. We ran out on Thanksgiving. We woke up and it was like all hell broke loose.
Wow.
We were kicking like, I can't remember, but we were kicking IV heroin use, like cold turkey. Jeez. And it was like, The Exorcist, man. Like,
that's both of you.
Both of us. Two of us. She was in my room. They put me in their room. They had no idea. Obviously, I say they have no idea. They knew, but...
not the severity, I imagine.
Not the severity, exactly. And that was one feeling that has always stayed with me, though. If anybody has kicked drugs like that, it is not a walk in the park. And then this is just one of those you would have thought, like, after that you would have thought I would have stayed clean.
Going
through that, you would have thought I stayed clean. So I did bring over a bunch of money with me. So me and my ex, we got our own place, we both got jobs, and even though we weren't using heroin or oxys or any opiates, so we were like, hoorah, we did it. We were still poly using, you know, alcohol, coke, weed, and all the party stuff. And like I mentioned before, you hang around the barbershop, you're going to get your hair cut. And was just hanging out with some old friends, and then the oxys came back out. And we relapsed on that. And then it didn't take very long for us to lose everything that we had.
All over again.
And talking about the insanity part of it. So this spout lasted probably about 7 or 8 months. And then, so we were living in our own place. We both had jobs. My ex lost her job a couple months in. And then so... okay, so now it's jogging my memory a little bit. Talk about ego, right? And masculinity. So I go from being this top dog, with a pretty good business going, always having money, always being able to support our habit, this and that, life was pretty good, quote unquote, going to now where, you know, we're barely making rent because I'm not selling anymore. Mm-hmm. My money is quickly drying up. My ex lost her job, so she was depending on me for doing everything. I was hustling like three different jobs at the time. All restaurant industry stuff, mm-hmm. but I was hustling like nonstop, trying to make it work, but also trying to support a habit. And then, I was trying to make it go as long as we can. It lasted for maybe 5 months of returning back home. And then that last 2 months, it was just like, I just gave up. I was exhausted. And we weren't paying our rent. We weren't paying any of the bills. Mm-hmm. We were basically living out of our car down. So we lived in one spot of the island. We didn't really know any connections there, but we knew where the connections were at this other part of the island, which is 45 minutes away, right? So we would literally like just live in our car in that side over of there. Town just because it was closer to the dope. Like it was just like craziness, you know what I mean? And so it's just like that's the cycle that you live in. And ultimately she left. You know, she left and she said that she was going, and this was just a godsend, you know what I mean? She said that she was going to go home for a week just to kind of visit her mom and do this and that. She ended up checking herself into rehab and staying there for 90 days. Okay. And so that was that separation that we needed. I continued to use for a little bit after that. I think it was about 2 weeks. And finally, I was going into work one day and I was trying to get a pill and the guy that I was getting it from ran off with my money. Mm. And this was only for like $20 or something like that, you know, but by then it was just the last drop. You know, I was just so sick of it. And like I said, it was ego, you know, like I go from this top dog to now getting ripped off for $20 and I'm just like,
and hating it and hurting it.
I was dope sick. I was sick of it. And, I just remember sitting in my car. We were at the parking lot of Safeway or something like that. And, you know, and like, I love my parents to death, you know, and I think they were always just waiting for this phone call. And I called them up and I was just like, where are you guys? Like, I need to talk to you. And they drove down to where I was at. We went to Starbucks and I finally just opened my heart to them. Everything came out, like, you know, dope sick, freaking, I'm a freaking addict, and like mm-hmm. this and that. And like, that was just such a big weight off my shoulder. And like, that's really the turning point in making that simple decision. I don't, you know, I made that post the other day about just like, we know what decisions we need to make to change our lives, but we're fearful of holding back. Mm-hmm. And that decision was something that completely changed the trajectory of my life.
And it's crazy because if you see that decision, I mean, obviously it's a big decision, but if you put it up against all the other decisions,
yeah,
it's for most people, it's like, it's so small,
yeah,
right? Like you just picked up the phone and call your parents and tell them that you want to talk, right? When you, again, put it up against all the other decisions you made, which were heavy and crazy and mm-hmm. just, I mean, lunatic to a certain extent, right? Like how, like, I don't think a lot of people would understand that, right? Or because I've had conversations with people and it's always this two-way road of like, why can't you just stop using?
Yeah.
Right? Like just stop. It's just obviously easier said than done, but why don't you just stop?
Which is why I try to be so transparent with my story mm-hmm. and because I would my hopes is ultimately just to break that kind of stereotype. And negative condensation connotations towards drug addicts. Mm-hmm, I mean, because like I said from the start, I didn't really grow up with a terrible life. I had more internal stuff going on. And addiction really is non-prejudice. Mm-hmm. They don't care what color skin you are, what, you know, what financial background you have. Mm-hmm. Like, it will get anybody. And also just bringing that full circle of just having that gut feeling, you know, and I finally just telling my parents with that. And you're just saying like all the other decisions that I made that were really scary, you know what I mean? Deep down. And I think I resonate with a lot of addicts. Deep down, we know, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? It's just you have this external factor now of influencing you other ways, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's really kind of, and it took years for me to practice and to regain it back. But now just getting and trusting that gut feeling again. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And some say gut feeling, some say that just that spiritual guidance, right. like whatever that is, just like to tap back into mm-hmm. that is and such a it major more than part. Anything, yeah.
Right? Just trusting it. So what'd your parents say? Or what was the next step from there?
Yeah. So the next step from there, you know, my mom being who my mom is always is very, you know, both of my parents, very loving. My or understanding. They, mm-hmm. you know, I that's the thing. It's like my parents have always been 100 with me, you know, supporting me regardless. I am the baby, so it's like, mm-hmm. you know.
Same here. So I know what that feels like.
I'm the baby. So, and you know, and in this whole thing, my middle sister, who's the one that's 3 years older than me, we grew up together. Like I kind of previewed before, my oldest sister's nine years older, and she boarded in high school and in college. So mm-hmm. there was, a lot mm-hmm. of time that I didn't really see her, but me and my middle sister grew up together and she always knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So like to backtrack a little story, like we visited my sister one time, me and my ex, and we were using at that time, and we stayed with them, and this is where she like there was she always found little things here and there, but this was the most extreme that she found. And when we left, I ended up leaving like a tourniquet and like a syringe or something like that, like blaring like hello. And of course she called me out on my shit, and of course I lied. I was mm-hmm. taking it to the grave, you know, like, I don't know what you're talking about. I made up some stupid addict excuse, and she cut me off.
Oh,
she said, I'm not talking to you. And so we went a good 2+ years without talking to each other. During all the course of all of this,
mm-hmm.
But no, and then so my parents trying to come back, and they just had a plan of attack. You know, there was a lot of other things going on during this time, but my mom took the initiative to kind of. I was working 7 days a week at this restaurant. She would give me a ride to and from work. Because I didn't trust myself. Like I said, I worked in the place where I knew where the dope was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
See, I was always very smart. I knew how to be an addict, right? And so it's like she gave me a ride to and from work, so I didn't have any distractions going home before I stopped using. And then shortly after I stopped using, I was seeing a therapist at the time, and he was always encouraging me to go to 12-step meetings and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So that was kind of my kind of guidance towards that. And I was still smoking weed, though. I was still drinking, but I knew that my way was not working anymore. Yeah. Like I knew deep down that gut feeling, I had to stop that if I really wanted to make it through this. And so I did. I did. I stopped doing that and then walked my ass into a meeting. And that's really where I was able to start stringing along these days clean.
Adding them up.
Yeah.
Them up together,
yeah, right. Stacking them up. And I just learned a lot. I mean, that's where my foundation of my recovery is based. This is in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. And it's just where it really stuck.
And with that, you know, with those meetings, is it how everybody portrays them to be, as far as obviously you just show up? You're just another face in the crowd. You kind of announce yourself. You introduce yourself.
And I think that's a blessing, too, because I got clean on Maui, right? So it's like it's a very small community of recovering addicts. Mm-hmm. So it's like it's a double-edged sword. Like you show up to these meetings, you see the same people
mm-hmm.
over and over and over again. But at the same time, you're seeing the same people
right.
over and over and over again. They eventually get to learn who you are, and they can all just call you on your bullshit when mm-hmm. you're trying to get swirly on them. You know what I mean?
Because they've all been there. They already know what to look for, right?
Yeah. And, you know, but I think that just holds so much power, too. And I've been asked, like, what has got you clean? And it's like, I kicked the IV cold turkey, and I kicked the pills cold turkey. And I've worked in the field, so I know that people just don't get off that scotch-free.
Mm-hmm.
It takes people a lot of years to try and string along clean days.
Right.
And like, I kind of go back to what I was saying. I've always had this really strong spiritual connection, and someone's guiding over me. and was able to help me get out of this pretty scary situation relatively harm-free. You know what I mean? Like, I never contracted any freaking diseases from needle use. Like, there was countless of sketchy situations where I could have died. And, no, I'm here today just thriving. So it's like some, you know, I've always really
believed
tapped that. Back into like, yes, I've got this guardian angel just guiding me through life. You know what I mean? And so, I forgot your original question.
What was that? What was that?
What was that?
As far as your parents, right?
Oh, the
like,
next step.
They took you in.
That's right.
And then, you know, you went to started going to
so I started, meetings. I started going to meetings. What's really powerful too is so, this all happened really fast too. As soon as I told my parents, like, I was now hitting the ground running, being clean.
I imagine would be an internal, like a great feeling, right? Like you're on.
Oh, it was like, I swear, you can talk to any newly recovering addict. The world literally is like sparkling. And so this was when I was 25. I started using at 11 or 12. I'd at that time been using for more than half of my life.
Crazy.
And I also started using so early. So it's like we say this, like when you get clean, you ultimately like revert back to your frame of mind of when you started using, which is scary, right? So it's like I was 25, blessed that I got clean early, but when I first got clean, I was literally thinking of like 11 and 12 year old. You know what I mean?
It's almost like that whole time of using,
all the emotional development is not processed.
Not there, right? It's not there.
Yeah. So it's like it's a very hard road. And I always preach that to my adolescents when I was counseling them. It's like you don't want to be like I always shared with them openly. It's like being 25, learning all that over again sucks. You don't want to be 30, 35, 40, 50
learning
that of an emotional like 12 year old. Like how hard is that? And then so, like I said, it all happened pretty fast. And so I told my parents, my therapist was encouraging me to go to 12 steps. I went to 12 steps, started making connections through there with the right people. And by, I think, 90 days clean, I made a down payment on my car without a cosigner. That was major. I don't know how that freaking happened. But that was like a major goal accomplishment for me of just being a functioning human being again. The other one was enrolling myself back in school. And I think that one was also a major turning point for me because growing up in school, I wasn't terrible. I was more of a C student, you know, right? Just getting by. I was a stoner, man. Like I was just getting by, you know what I mean? And so now being clean and going to school, I made the dean's list and passed multiple semesters. Like my new standard was 4.0. And like that was just unheard of. But I was just like, man, school's so easy when you're not going freaking loaded every day. But yeah, so I ended up I was going back to school for substance abuse counseling. Ultimately met my wife in class, and it was just such a, I think with, and then fitness. So like that also got thrown into the mix. So you've got like my connections with my family, staying clean or rekindling my relationships with my family, staying clean, education and fitness. Like that really helped me bounce back further and gave me a purpose, right? I really owe so much to school and fitness because it really taught me the discipline and having structure that I needed in the early stages of recovery. And then shortly after that, my friends that played paintball caught wind that I was back. I was clean,
right?
You know what I mean? And then so they're like, man, you should come out. There's this tournament coming up. And you should come play with us. So I ended up going and playing this tournament, and was the first time back, you know, on the field since for like at least 4 years. And
just felt good.
If we won the tournament,
even better.
And we won the tournament, and it was like it came down to this one last play, and I had a major role in us winning that point. So it was just like major confidence booster. Instantly reignited that that flame that I have this love for paintball again. And so like all of this is just this concoction that just really resonated with me to stay clean. Like I really started to weigh the benefits over the cons, right?
Right.
And but then like that being said, like I still made it out and I don't really have a particular method to how I did it. But yeah, and so it's like to kind of speed along, like ended up graduating with my I'll cut it short. I graduated with my associates. Ended up being a counselor for adult, and then I switched to adolescence. Was playing paintball again, got in a new relationship that was healthy, reconnected with my sister. So like all of these good things were happening and brought me to the point now to 2017 where I strung along. I was 5-6 years clean. I was in my bachelor's, working towards my bachelor's of psychology now. And me and my wife, I proposed to my wife, or, you know, my girlfriend, my wife now. And we both had the same mindset, and we talked about it at the time of really wanting to give the mainland. And for people that don't know what the mainland is, that's just the United States. And we wanted to give it a shot. She'd never lived off the island before.
Oh.
Yeah. And then I wanted to give it a shot because I'm clean now. I wanted to do it right. And then so this was at the end of 2017. Well, I proposed in July. And then in December, I got asked to play for this professional team up here. And so that's the end of 2017. 2018, February, we quit our jobs. She was in the human services field as well. So we both quit our jobs. We got married. We moved. As soon as we moved, I had our first tournament of playing professional paintball, like 2 weeks after that. And then I was in my last semester of finishing school, all within a month.
Just right there.
All within a month. It was wild. It was such a roller coaster.
Making an adventure.
Yeah. So, I mean, just talking about getting out of your comfort zone in a good way, right? Really testing those boundaries and testing your grit.
And also testing, quote unquote, the faith, right?
Yes. Like it was a leap of faith.
Because everything is lining up and we're doing everything the right way.
Yes.
And if we, you know, continue this path, then it's just going to work out.
And I think someone prior to all of this, someone told me, they were giving me marriage advice. And they're like, never switch your jobs, move location, or do anything drastic within the first year of marriage.
Here we go.
And my addict self's like, Roger that. Yeah.
Straight to the limit.
And so that first year of marriage was pretty crazy, man. And then, you know, and just all of that course of stuff and the leap of faith and I always now try and live in that little zone that's just one step out of your comfort zone, because you're able to just push the boundaries and grow, have gotten confident and comfortable in that. And the whole leap of faith and stuff. Obviously, I'm human and fear does come up and stuff like that. But I have practiced enough times to know that I have all of the capabilities of coming out on the other end. And all of these trials and tribulations that I've gone through have just conditioned me to where my mindset is today.
And I think that speaks, volumes, because in the coaching, with La Tribu that I do, a lot of people come and there's always this thought that you have to have gone through hard stuff to be able to have that type of mentality. And I say yes and no, right? Because there's a lot of people that have that mentality and didn't have nearly as hard as a road as you did, right? But I also believe that going through that obviously pushes that limit just a little bit further, because it's almost like you've been in the darkest place you've ever been in and made it through.
Yeah.
Right? So why not keep pushing that, right? And it's almost like the adrenaline feel. So how can I just keep pushing the envelope to where mm-hmm. it's satisfying and it's pushing me to the point where I just know that every time I step out a little bit more, I'm growing more and more and more and more.
Yeah, and I think to just bounce off of that, I don't think that there is an exact blueprint for anybody. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? We all have our own journeys, and it doesn't matter if you, because there's people that have crazier stories than I mm-hmm. do, right? Oh, yeah. And then there's people that don't have as, you know, we all just come in at different points on the spectrum. And what I really try and do, and what I bring with Off the Leash, is it's about the people that you surround yourself with. Mm-hmm. Like me being around you, me being around Luca, me being around Theo, all the coaches here, all the paintball players that I'm around, I pull from them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it doesn't matter if I directly had an experience mm-hmm. with this situation, but if I know someone that had an experience with this, I'm going to reach out to them, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then help, let them help me get through this. Mm-hmm. And I mm-hmm. think that that just really helps with people that, and I hear it, you know, I'm with you with coaching and stuff like that. I hear people come with problems, or not problems, just barriers, and mm-hmm. they want a blueprint on how to get through it. And it's like, you have to experience that right. for yourself, right? Right? And I think a big part of Off the Leash is ensuring that it's okay to fail, mm-hmm. you know, that we're all here together in a community to pick you back up and help you learn from the mistakes, and vice versa for me too. And it's like, mm-hmm. I think it's just really about that. I love, like, and so like coming into Vigor has been a real mile marker for my journey as well. And you know, it's the rise as one, you mm-hmm. know, it's like really as a community, we can all just help each other elevate.
Right. Lean on each other for yes. sure. So tell me a little bit about how Off the Leash, share a little bit about Off the Leash, first of all, so a lot okay. of people that don't know what that is, and how that came to be.
Yeah, man. Off the Leash is my baby, my project. I absolutely love it. And I've always wanted to do something like that, you know. It was always a big dream of mine to have my own clothing company, but that doesn't necessarily tie into Off the Leash. I just wanted to have my own thing,
right?
Right.
Right.
And so I think Off the Leash is just a buildup of my life and meeting the right people at the right time, and sparks fly and something ignites, you know what I mean? And so when I initially moved up here, I was working delivering flowers is just a band-aid to get us going, and I was out of my career as in the human services field. I knew I didn't really want to go back, and this was just me being selfish. I just there was just so much substance abuse going on, whether that's with my counseling part mm-hmm. or my own recovery. It was just so much substance abuse in my world that I needed to just focus on my own. So I took a step back and then was trying to reevaluate what I wanted to do. And my wife, you know, she was always like, hello, like if it's not a blaring red sign in front of you, you should go into fitness, like, because fitness has always been a big part of my new self, my new identity. And I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. And ultimately landed this job up north behind the desk, and then took the steps that needed to go into personal training. So it was up at this new spot that I met this other individual, Jeremy, and we just hit it off. And yeah, it's just like when people enter in your lives and for a reason, and it just clicks, mm-hmm. and it's like instant fam, you know what I mean? And he always would watch me in the gym before we really got to talking. And he was always like, man, Patty's a beast off the leash. You know what I mean? And he always was telling the other staff members that, and was telling me that. And then when we finally connected, he was just like, man, you're off the leash. And it kind of just stuck. And then like us vibing together and stuff like that, we're like, we should really do something. And we really didn't know where Off the Leash was going to go. And so this is where like the apparel stuff came in, and they're like, fuck, we should make a shirt. And we made this shirt, and it's the one with the teeth, and mm-hmm. and yep. you made it. No, that was the other one.
I bought one.
You bought one. I have one. So we made that shirt, and like and it was just this project that we did, and like the feedback that we got from it was like, hey, how do we be a part of Off the Leash? And I just feel this type of way when I put this shirt on, this and that. And we're like, and we started getting all of this stuff through Instagram of just messages of people sharing their stories. And like, this was literally of just us making a shirt and like all these people sharing their stories about resilience and like how they wear this shirt and how they love like Off the Leash and they want to be a part of it. And it just really grew organically. And we're just like, we sat down, we're like, dude, we got something magical here. We should do something. And so we did. And me having the professional paintball platform kind of was launching it through there. And yeah, ultimately, like with all of that feedback from everybody, it just kind of grew to like Off the Leash just being this community of people that are reluctant to just stay stagnant. They want to grow. They, you know, they want to step out into that uncomfortable zone and just push the boundaries every day. And ultimately, like I said kind of earlier, it's like having that group of people to have your back when you fail and take that stigma about failing as a negative, you know, as a negative, but then flip it into a positive. So it's really just, in a nutshell, kind of that. It's just like it's turned more into just a mindset and an identity.
Right.
I do my training programs for paintball players on there. We have our podcast. We do have a clothing line out. So we do have these other avenues that we're able to deliver this message now.
Which is a powerful thing to do, right? Because a lot of times people focus and they have this one track mind of, like, this is the only way I'm going to get my message out. But like for you, imagine if you would have never made that shirt.
Right.
Right. Like nothing that came after that. Maybe it would have come, but it wouldn't have come full force how it did.
Right.
And I think in my opinion, it wouldn't have had that quick connection to the mindset. Right. Yeah. It would have just been a brand.
Right.
Like it's a cool shirt.
Which is something that we've always wanted to not be. Right. It's not just like that brand. And I think it's been extremely humbling that it happened organically like it did, where people were reaching out and just wanted to be a part of this thing that we didn't even know what it was yet.
Right.
So like now that we're kind of chiseling it and forging it into our own little project, it's been a lot of fun, man.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
So share a little bit about where people can find you, whether it's your IG, your website, whatever it is you guys got going.
Yeah, we got a couple different things. We just had our website launched. It's offtheleashlifestyle.com. You can reach me via email through Off the Leash at offtheleashathlete@gmail.com. And then my the Instagram is at Off the Leash Lifestyle, and then my personal account is at Patty Gleason.
And for people that don't know, you know, he kind of touched on it, but Patty is one of our coaches here at Vera Ground in Seattle, and he's got, you know, I encourage everybody to follow him for the content he puts out, whether it's just training programs. He's always recording some pretty dope exercises in the gym.
I go wild out a little bit, man, for sure.
But I mean, obviously he knows what he's talking about. Obviously, you know, if he didn't, he wouldn't be a part of the bigger fam. But I just want to say thank you for taking the time to share your story, man. I really appreciate the openness to share, and I, you know, I think this is going to be a powerful episode for many reasons, but more for people that are listening and maybe are stuck in a certain situation that they just don't know how to get out of, right? Yeah. But I think I appreciate the fact that you pointed out the spiritual connection,
yeah,
and how that, you know, because that's the way I am, and I live my life by that. Is you just know when you're missing it or when you're not close to it.
Yeah.
So again, I just want to say thank you, and you know, look out for the next episode.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I said it before, and I'll say it again. Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.